Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The deep sea is a mysterious and foreboding place. More than 80% of the ocean still remains unexplored, home to wondrous and strange sea creatures, shipwrecks and alien vistas. It's technology that's allowed us to scratch the surface of this realm in the form of submersibles. And like space travel, there are inherent dangers in this type of exploration, as we saw with the tragic loss of the Titan in 2023, a submersible that was destroyed en route to the Titanic wreckage site, tragically killing all those on board. Hello and welcome to Patented, a podcast about the history of inventions from History Hit with me, Dallas Campbell. Today, I'm joined by one of the world's leading marine archaeologists. It's Canadian Rob Rondeau to talk about the history of submersibles, the good and the bad, the past, the present, and the future. Hey, Rob, welcome to the show. It's lovely to have you with us.
Oh, thank you, Dallas. Yeah, no, it's a great opportunity.
It's an odd one, isn't it? Because here we are a month or so on after the Ocean Gate tragedy. It's a sort of depressingly relevant topic, I suppose, to be discussing. Well, it's still sort of fresh in our minds. And I know you've written a lot about Ocean Gate and kind of what happened. And I thought before we get onto the history of submersibles, of which you are an expert, I might just sort of get your take, if that's okay, about what happened with the Ocean Gate. In fact, I read somewhere that it was an article that you'd written. You talked about the similarities, actually, between what happened on the Titanic and what happened in Ocean Gate. And actually, the thing that you mentioned in this article was the proximity of the Titanic and the death of Scott in the Antarctic, and how those three tragedies were all linked by a sort of misunderstanding, or a not really preparing well enough, or not having the right equipment, or ignoring the warning signs.
Yeah, you know, Ocean Gate, the whole thing is really strange, especially given the fact that deep sea submersibles have been used now for over 60 years, and there's never been an accident. This is the first. And yeah, as you were saying, there is a connection between the three. Call it hubris, call it sort of an old Edwardian approach, you know, in terms of sort of damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. You know, in Edward Smith's case, the captain of the Titanic, he had disregarded warnings all during the day coming from other ships that there was ice ahead. And he just flatly disregarded those. And in terms of Robert Scott, others were telling him, like, look, you don't take tractors and ponies to Antarctica.
Well, I tell you, the thing is, I'd finished reading the book, Cherry Garrard's The Worst Journey in the World, which I don't know if you've read. It's the most extraordinary description of that expedition. And all the way through, you see those signs because, of course, Amundsen, he took dogs with him and got to the South Pole. And, of course, Scott took horses and all kinds of things and just didn't have that sense is the wrong word, but just didn't have that experience to understand how to do it. Whereas Amundsen, who'd grown up in the North, did. He understood how polar exploration really should be conducted.
Well, the thing that all three men had in common is that they didn't listen. If you look at Amundsen, like, for example, he had learned from the Canadian Inuit. Like, he'd spent time in the Arctic and he'd learned their ways. And the same thing, you know, with Stockton Rush. Like, he disregarded, you know, experts in the field who were saying, look, you're going about this the wrong way. You know, you can't use carbon fiber to build a submersible.
Stockton Rush, he's the captain of the OceanGate submersible.
Yeah. So he was the captain of the Titan submersible, but he was also the CEO of OceanGate. So really, it was his project. It was his baby. And all three men were thoroughly convinced that they would succeed. And unfortunately, all three of them, you know, not only did they fail, but they failed fatally, you know, and all three died as a result of their poor decisions.
I mean, it had such global attention, this particular mission. And I suppose it was that ticking clockness about it that held our attention. It's like, okay, we've got to find this thing, and they've only got the oxygen's running out. It had that kind of Apollo 13 sense of drama. But I wonder, from your point of view, did you have doubts about the craft? Did you have doubts about him? Like, what was going through your mind?
Oh, yeah. I'm in Vancouver, which isn't that far away from Everett, Washington, where OceanGate is based. And so there were rumors within the undersea technology community about what was going on. But I think it was one of those things where nobody really sort of took it seriously. Everybody kind of knew that there was this sort of wingnut company that was trying to go to the Titanic with this new craft, was sort of defying what others, you know, were saying, you know, needs to be in place. And it was kind of a sleeper, despite the fact that, you know, OceanGate was marketing to billionaires and people were willing to pay $250,000, you know, to go in this, what we now know as a death trap, you know, to Titanic. And the really amazing thing is that they had two seasons of dives before the third and final one. So, you know, they took a number of people down, and it's really in some ways remarkable that this accident didn't happen sooner.
You're an expert on shipwrecks and how we preserve shipwrecks as an archaeologist. What do you think about this idea of the Titanic being a kind of tourist destination? I'm always been a bit uncomfortable with it.
Well, you're right. First and foremost, it's a gravesite. You know, others like Robert Ballard, for example, who found the wreck of the Titanic in 1985, he said that it should be off limits to call it tourism submersibles or submarine tourism. I don't know if I would necessarily go that far, but regardless who goes to the Titanic, they have to do so safely. And again, you know, in some ways, it was strange that there's two wreck sites, you know, in that particular part of the ocean.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. When people go down there now, that story of the Titanic, it has got that coda now of OceanGate as well as part of the narrative, as it were. It's going to be an odd thing to...
It's part of the canon now, I guess you could say. You know, but the sort of the strange thing is like, from a scientific perspective, we've analyzed the wreck of the Titanic very thoroughly. In fact, last year there was a 3D imaging project where they actually took ROVs down, remotely operated vehicles, and they did photogrammetry. So basically these ROVs took millions of photographic images, which then are stitched together using a computer afterwards. And so it's a complete 3D rendering of what the shipwreck looks like. So we have really as much data about the shipwreck, really, that any researcher needs. And of course, you know, over time, it's always good to go back to a wreck site and see how the wreck has deteriorated, because that's also part of the narrative. But I think what Rush was trying to cater to is this need for experience. There's a lot of people that want to be able to say they've been to Titanic.
It's a bit of a box-ticking thing, I suppose. It's like, okay, well, we've been to space now with Jeff Bezos or whoever, and we've been up the top of Everest. Now we're going to go and do the Titanic. It just seems like a bit of a rich person's box-ticking thing.
Well, there's like a number of people that went with Rush. You know, they apparently, it's been in the news that they mortgaged their houses. And, you know, there was one that person that decided not to have kids and go to the Titanic instead. So, you know, people are motivated by a number of different reasons. I know I've been asked by a number of people, like, would I go? And I said, yeah, if I was asked to go as part of a scientific expedition, of course I would go. But if it was just for the sake of being able to say that I went, no, I wouldn't go.
If there's a reason to do it, for whatever it is, for professional reasons, you know, I can understand that. Because you were involved in the Franklin wreckages as well, the famous Northwest Passage shipwrecks that were found, I think 2016, was it, or around about then?
The Erebus was found in 2014 and Terror was found in 2016. And I had actually been involved looking for the wrecks prior to that. So I was up there from 2009 to 2013. And of course, as it often goes, I'd moved over to another project and it was found the year after in 2014. And, you know, again, you know, that is another example of not being adequately prepared. You know, all the crew died as a result.
It's an amazing story still, that particular story. Let's talk about submersibles, though, because I want to do a little bit about the history of how, you know, the fact that we can now go and find these wrecks and other wrecks as well, which we might talk about. Just before we move on, the difference to our listeners between something like a submarine, which we are familiar with, and a submersible. Like, what's the difference between these two things? And where do we start with the history of submersibles?
Sure. Well, there's two basic things that separate them. So a submarine can operate independent. So, for example, if you think of submarines that you've seen in movies, for example, they can go from port to port. They can operate independent of, you know, surface support. The other thing with submarines is they typically don't go that deep. You know, usually within, you know, a couple thousand, you know, feet or 1,000 meters, for example. So a submersible typically is used for research. Actually, there's three things. The other thing is the number of people that can go in them. So a submarine, of course, can house a large crew. So submersible, it needs a surface support vessel, can't operate independently, can go much deeper. And typically they house usually three people. So a pilot and then two passengers or specialists.
So you're always attached. Is that the idea with a submersible, that you're attached by some kind of...
No, you're not attached by an umbilical, but you need the surface support vessel. So, okay. For example, it's lifted off of the vessel to dive and then it's brought back on the vessel. And then to go back to port or like to go out from port, you know, it's on board the surface support ship. And the one difference that Titan did this season in comparison to its two other seasons is prior to this season, it had used a surface support vessel in the traditional means that a submersible is used. So it was actually the Arctic Prince that took it out from St. John's. And then at the site, the Titan submersible was offloaded and then it dove to the wreck and it came back and was put back onto the Arctic Prince and taken back to port. This year, it was actually towed. So it was towed by another vessel called the Polar Prince, same company, and it was towed out on this little barge. And it looks like there have been a number of problems in doing that. In fact, it was partially sunk when it arrived on the site. So myself and others have speculated that that may have caused some harm actually to the submersible, and that may have contributed to its ultimate demise. So that's an interesting thing. But, you know, typically, you know, research submersibles are small and, you know, they dive off a support ship.
We'll go in a moment to the kind of the history of deep sea exploration. But is there a kind of submersible one? Like, I remember seeing the, I forget who it was now, in the bathysphere that went all the way down to the bottom of the trench. And, it, you know, basically a huge kind of like solid iron sphere that would withstand the pressure. And I guess that was 1950s maybe.
1960. And so that was Jacques Picard and U.S. Navy Lieutenant Don Walsh. And that was the Bathyscape Trieste.
Were there some submersibles before that? That's in my mind. I always kind of go to that one as the first example of a crewed submersible.
You're right in terms of it was the first submersible to dive to the deepest depth on the planet. So, you know, it dove to the Challenger Deep in the Mariana Trench. Like most recently, James Cameron, you know, also dove to that in a different submersible. Especially at the time in the late 50s, early 60s, it was sort of the aqua equivalent to the space program. And the U.S. Navy actually sort of, you know, they had their own undersea program, just like NASA had its space program. But in terms of submersibles, the concept of going underwater has been around really since there's been people. People have tried to use, you know, bamboo reeds to snorkel underwater. But really, the first individual that sort of conceived the idea of a submersible was William Bourne. He lived in the 1500s. But the first person to design and build a submersible was the Dutchman Cornelius Drebbel. And that was in 1620. And apparently it was like, you know, basically a little hull in the shape of a turtle. And it had two oars sticking up the sides so that you could use to sort of paddle around underwater. It wouldn't have gone very deep. The first sort of documented submersible was David Bushnell's in 1775. And again, he designed a similar kind of submersible. And they tried to destroy a British warship using it. So the idea was is that he would paddle this thing up and then he would plant a charge into the side of the hull. Unfortunately, it didn't work. But, you know, and also, again, that's another consistency is submersibles being, you know, being associated with navies.
Well, that's it. I mean, the idea of like, we want to build something like a submersible, was it motivated by conflict? Were they devices for war or devices for science? Because presumably we've been doing, you know, deep sea exploration for science for donkey's years as well.
Well, again, you know, if you look at like Trieste and its, you know, and its predecessors, they were all built by the Navy, by the U.S. Navy. And other navies, Italy, Germany, they experimented with the same. Of course, they had their own submarine programs. Even if you look at Titanic, for example, it's not sort of well known in the story of how Robert Ballard found Titanic, but he was actually part of a U.S. Navy program. And basically the U.S. Navy had said to him, we want you to go and find two nuclear submarines, the wrecks of these submarines that had been lost in the 60s. And he said, okay, I'll do this and I'll use my new technology, this video camera sled called Argo. And he said, I'll go find your submarines, your lost submarines, but I'm going to also go look for Titanic. So he actually found the wrecks of Thresher and Scorpion, and then he went to Titanic. And it's funny because the world media in the 1980s, you know, the Cold War was still on, but they didn't focus on that part. They just focused. They were so excited that Titanic had been found.
How the hell did two nuclear submarines go missing? When did that happen?
Well, in both cases, they had imploded. And so, right. Of course, in the whole world of espionage, the U.S. Navy, they wanted to make sure that, one, those wreck sites had not been found by the Russians. And, of course, you know, the concern was is, you know, the enemy could have analyzed the reactors. And, of course, there was also the possibility that maybe the enemy had sunk these submarines. And Ballard was able to locate these wreck sites and was able to, the footage of the wreck showed that it had been internal damage, that they had basically exploded underwater. And an implosion is the exact opposite of an explosion. So if you think of a giant explosion, like maybe what you've seen in the movies, imagine that in the reverse.
Which is what happened to the Titan and the Ocean Gate.
Yeah, they would have died instantly once the hull you know, was compromised. At that depth, it's 400 times surface pressure. So, you know, you can only imagine, or you can imagine, you know, what that kind of pressure would be like.
Give us an idea, Rob, of the kind of the technologies that allowed submersibles to be built. Like, what was it? I mean, when I think about the Trieste and that bathysphere, it just looks like a big metal ball that you kind of drop. But what were the kind of key technologies that really opened up the field of undersea exploration? Was it video cameras or was it the materials that we use to make the submersibles that suddenly opened this field up?
You're entirely right, Dallas. I think it's sort of the other way around. It was the hull technology that came first, and the cameras and the lighting, you know, that came second. The reason why a sphere is used is a sphere, when it descends, the pressure is distributed equally around it because it's a circle. And that was really the problem with the Titan submersible, is because what Stockton Rush had done is he had taken a sphere and cut it in half and put a tube in between. And that's what they do with it with a submarine. But unlike a submarine, he'd used carbon fiber for that tube. And carbon fiber, it's great on an aircraft. But for example, a surfboard is made from carbon fiber. So what he was thinking was, if we use these many, many layers of individual, you know, layers of carbon fiber, that would be as strong as steel, especially titanium. But clearly it was not. And so if you look at like every other deep sea submersible, they still use a sphere. And there's another reason for that is typically the sphere is also a lifeboat. So if you look at, like, for example, Robert Ballard, when he first went to Titanic, he used Alvin. Alvin, its design is a sphere. And although it doesn't look like that when you see photos of it, it's the same with James Cameron's submersible, Victor Vescovo's submersible, is there's still a sphere. And if the submersible gets into trouble, they can actually close that sphere and then jettison to the surface. Titan didn't have that. And that's another thing is when you work underwater, it's all about redundancy. It doesn't matter if you're scuba diving or if you're going in a submersible, you have to have backup, backup, backup. Titan didn't have that. This wasn't like some sort of new and innovative thing. It's not like, you know, nobody had been to the deepest parts of the ocean. So he was really sort of, you know, flying in the face of existing technology and knowledge.
Hey, I'm Don Wildman, and on American History Hit, my expert guests and I journey across the nation and through the years to uncover the stories that have made the United States. From first flight to first ladies, from stitching the Star-Spangled Banner to striking gold in California, to shooting for the moon with Apollo, we've got you covered. Catch new episodes of American History Hit, a podcast by History Hit, every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There are interesting parallels between our quest to explore space and our quest to explore the bottom of the oceans. And the, so the way that we design craft, there are similarities in the way that they look. Spacecrafts and submersibles, they seem to be related in a way.
Well, you know, both outer space and deep inner space are hostile environments. So, you know, it requires a lot of technology and, you know, a lot of money. Like, for example, Victor Vescovo, in 2019, he dove to Titanic in a submersible made by a company called Triton, but it cost $50 million to build that submersible.
Where does the money go? I mean, like you say, a sphere is a sphere. When I looked at the bathysphere, the Trieste of 1960 that we talked about, it's just like a big hunk of metal.
Right. Well, of course, the newer submersibles like James Cameron Deep Sea Challenger or Victor Vescovo's Limiting Factor was the name of his submersible. In addition to being comprised of a sphere in which the occupant sits, they're tricked out with all the latest sensor technology and, of course, cameras and lights. It's interesting because there's an IMAX movie that's playing here in Vancouver about James Cameron and the Deep Sea Challenger. So the motivations are a little different than when you know, Picard and Walsh went down. They were basically just going to be able to sort of touch the bottom to say, you know, we've been here and then go back. Whereas, you know, Vescovo is very much about collecting. He's been to the highest points on the Earth and he's been to the lowest, you know, points on Earth. But with Cameron, he seems to be more intrigued with the science and the technology that's used to do deep sea exploration.
You know, for the collectors, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Now the Titanic's kind of been done. What are the Everests left to conquer in this world? Like, where are people going to go?
It depends on sort of what you're looking for. In terms of the deepest parts of the ocean, yeah, they've now been dove. But you have to remember that we know so little about our oceans. You know, we know more about the dark side of the moon than we do our deepest oceans. And when you think that the Earth is 70% water, That's a lot of territory that we don't know nothing about. And personally, and I always say this, is let's explore, you know, the deep oceans before looking at other planets, because, you know, there's so much to learn. And in terms of shipwrecks, there are deeper shipwrecks than Titanic. There's still a number of World War II shipwrecks in the Pacific that have not been found. And I suspect that that's where those that are interested in sort of deep wrecks, that they'll look to now.
For you personally, when it comes to wreck hunting, I mean, Erebus and Terror, I mean, those were the two wrecks that people had heard of that everyone wanted to find, that were kind of lost in legend and mythology. And suddenly now we've got them again. Like, if you could like find a wreck today, what would it be?
Oh, well, there's a number of shipwrecks that people are looking for. You know, of course, the one thing is with shipwrecks, there's always the connection with gold.
I dived on it was the Atocha I went to. Have you come across
that? Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah, off the coast of
Florida.
Florida. Yeah, we're off the coast of Florida with Mel Fisher, who you've probably heard of. So I went down. Well, funny, there's no wreckage at all. There's no ship. There's just an area where they look for gold. And he's, you know, I'm sure you know the story. He found, I mean, that there was something like $400 million worth of gold and silver bullion and emeralds and all kinds of stuff that went down. This was a Spanish ship that was going from America back to Spain that got caught in a hurricane in that area. I didn't find anything. I found some musket balls. But then I got quite a lot of kickback from archaeologists saying, like, you know, you shouldn't be doing this kind of stuff. These places should be sort of left alone. I never quite know what the kind of correct procedure is. And, you know, this idea of treasure hunting, which is frowned upon by archaeologists, and where the line is and what we should and shouldn't be doing.
You make a salient point, and it's certainly something that's discussed a lot. I knew Mel Fisher. I only met him once, but I had lunch with him at a McDonald's in Sebastian Inlet. I was having lunch with him and Mole Molinar, who was his partner at that time. If you know the Mel Fisher story, he actually was living in California at the time. And so he brought his vessel, the Virgilona.
Just briefly, in a line for our listeners, explain who Mel Fisher is.
Yeah, so Mel Fisher started out as a chicken farmer in California. And he was fascinated when he learned about the Spanish colonial presence in the New World, was fascinated by stories of treasure. It's actually really a horrible story, because they forced the indigenous peoples of Central and South America to mine for gold and silver, and all of that treasure went back to Spain. And it was largely used to fund the wars that were going on in Europe, you know, at the time. He came with the Virgilona down through the Panama Canal. And in doing that, he picked up a mechanic, Mole Molinar, who went on to become his partner and later then started another company, which I worked for. We're having lunch with Mel Fisher. And so I assumed we were going to a nice fancy restaurant.
Yeah, because
he's like the legend. And we go to McDonald's, and both of them were dressed in like very, you know, very just sort of average, you know, clothes you buy at Walmart. But they had these giant gold coins with these giant gold, you know, necklaces, you know, these chains around their neck.
I saw the chain.
Yeah, exactly. And Mel and Mo were famous for that. And I worked on the 1715 plate fleet just to the north, the Atocha is in the Florida Keys, but these were up the Gold Coast. And at the time, the state was working with companies that were contracting archaeologists. And so contract archaeology existed for really till the 90s. And then it was really phased out because of the opposition of largely academic archaeologists. And, you know, so I've been a contract archaeologist, but now I'm also an academic archaeologist. So I see it from both sides. And really, it comes down to the same with submersibles. You have to play by the rules, and the rules have to be clearly defined. And that's not the case all over the world. There are countries that are not part of, say, for example, the United Nations Convention on Protecting Shipwrecks. And so they have, you know, their own rules. And a lot of those are in Asia or in Africa. And so there's still a lot of treasure hunting going on in those parts of the world. The other thing that really sort of changed it was what's called sovereign immunity. And that is the right of a nation to lay claim to a shipwreck if the ship was under its flag. So, for example, all those Spanish shipwrecks, those Spanish treasure ships, Spain will lay claim to. And that's happened in the last 20 years. So people that found these ships, they've had to basically give the loot back to Spain. So there isn't the kind of incentive that there used to be. And you don't really see very much of that happening anymore.
I mean, there's still that Atocha, that particular ship, there's still a lot of gold down there, apparently. But I'm just wondering, I mean, how many gold ships were wrecked? I mean, are there Dozens or hundreds or?
Thousands.
Oh, really? Okay.
The Spanish were basically in the Americas actively, you know, extracting the wealth of those nations for 300 years. Hurricanes happened, you know, lots of ships were lost. So yeah, there's still a lot of ships to be found. I'm more interested in ships that have a personal story, for example, ships that where there's been people lost and their loved ones or their descendants would like to know what happened to them.
There's a couple of big stories that still, a bit, I suppose, a little bit like Titanic, just continue to fascinate. And that's, where is the wreck of Amelia Earhart's aeroplane? Seems to be the one that, crikey, every TV network still does that one. The other one a little bit closer to home for us is Amy Johnson, who always gets overlooked. The wreck of Amy Johnson's plane. She was a compatriot of Amelia Earhart, who also died, was lost at sea in a plane. No one's found her wreck. No one ever found what happened to it.
Yeah, I've actually been involved in the search for Amelia Earhart. So I'm very familiar with that one. You know, Amy Johnson, I know the name and I know the story, but like I haven't been involved in that one. But even in the UK, you've got, if you talk about aircraft, and aircraft wrecks are considered shipwrecks. But there's the Glenn Miller, you know,
yes.
You know, aircraft that was lost during the Second World War. But then, of course, there's so many ships from World War One and World War Two, all through the North Sea, all around the UK. So there is no shortage of shipwrecks worldwide.
And submersibles, yeah. Just in terms of submersibles, the idea that small craft, these are now the tool for hunting for these kinds of wrecks and getting the information that we need.
The really amazing thing is that submersibles have gotten a lot smaller. Like, so now there are individual submersibles. And I'm working with a company here in Vancouver called Nutco. They actually have what's called the exosuit.
So oh, it kind of I've looks seen like, it. It's awesome. It's like a the old Victorian diving suit mixed with a high-tech crazy space suit.
There was the Newt suit before it, and it looks like that. But the exosuits look more like Iron Man.
So yes.
They're a lot closer to you. And I've been in one, and I'm hoping to use one next summer in some of my research. It's not really like being in a submersible. It's like being in a suit of armor. And you operate it with your feet. You steer it with your feet. There's pedals and, you know, where your feet are. That's how you steer. That's how you go forward and go backwards.
I've always been fascinated by those suits. When we talk about submersibles, those ideas of big Victorian diving suits, you know, with the great sort of brass helmets and things. And there was another one. There's a, I think it's a Finnish suit. And I think it's called the Old Man or something. It's made out of leather. It's a kind of diving suit made of leather. It's the most peculiar looking thing. And goodness knows when it was made. But that idea of fashioning suits that let us explore the deep seemed to go back a long way.
That's referred to as hard hat diving or hard hat, you know, systems. The most common one is what's referred to as the U.S. Navy Mark V. That's really sort of the classic, you know, dive helmet. But those are different than the submersibles because all submersibles are what's referred to as a one atmosphere system. So what that means is that you're in the same atmosphere that you are now. So you can go down, you can dive, you can come back, you can open the hatch, and you can, you know, you're completely safe. Whereas those systems are like scuba diving. So then you have to decompress. Like I've spent, you know, literally hours in the water because, you know, you may be on the bottom, you know, for an hour, but your decompression time may be 4 or 5 hours or even longer, depending on what depth you're working at. And the human body really can't go below 1,000 feet or, you know, 300, you know, meters. There have been divers that have worked deeper, but they've all had sort of catastrophic health issues as a result. We as humans, we're not really suited. You know, you look at whales and dolphins, they're much better suited to work underwater, to be underwater than we are.
Same with space travel. You know, the human imagination was built for space travel and was built to explore the depths of the oceans. And so much good science fiction has been written about it. Unfortunately, the human body needs a bit of catching up. You know, we're not designed as rigorously as the imagination, which can go anywhere.
Well, fortunately, we have the imagination to design the technology that allows us to do those things.
The exosuit, though, is that pressurized? Is that a one atmosphere suit?
Yeah.
Or do you still have to?
No, it's completely, you know, pressurized. Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. What was the movie with Ed Harris where they find the aliens underwater?
The Abyss.
Yeah, the Abyss. The film. And they have the kind of the suit where they have the liquid oxygen that they kind of breathe in.
The company that I'm working with, Nutco, they actually designed that equipment for James Cameron when they made The Abyss.
Not with a liquid that you can breathe, like in the movie.
The Navy has experimented with that. The U.S. Navy has experimented. Because if you think about it, you know, we've all, you know, been in a liquid environment for the first 9 months of our life.
Well, that's it. Just in case you haven't seen the film, listener, The Abyss. So Ed Harris, I can't remember what, they're exploring the bottom of the ocean for reasons I can't remember, and they find aliens.
They want to make contact with this alien ship on the bottom.
But the device that they used to do it, so they put the helmet on, and it's such a claustrophobic thing to watch, the liquid being pumped in. But the idea is that the helmet fills with liquid, but you can breathe the liquid. Exactly as you say, we're sort of going back into the womb where the liquid's filled with oxygen or whatever. And it's a terrifying thing to watch, but then they can breathe. Crikey, that's a real thing, or real-ish.
It's real-ish. It's been experimented with, but it's nothing that's being, you know, used, you know, operationally. But all the other technology, like, for example, the helmets, the submersibles, those were, you know, largely built here in Vancouver, or they were designed here and then they were used in Hollywood. And James Cameron has a very strong connection to Newco and other companies here in Vancouver.
James Cameron directed it, of course, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah. You know, and Cameron is really interesting because, you know, like I've heard him in interviews say that when he made the movie Titanic, the big blockbuster, he wasn't interested in making a movie. He wanted to go see Titanic. And so he came up with a movie and pitched the movie to the studio so that they would pay for him being able to lease the submersibles to go down there.
That's the way to do it, you see. I've been trying to do the Amy Johnson documentary, The Story of Amy Johnson, which is extraordinary. Everyone wants to know about Amelia Earhart, which is an extraordinary story, but Amy Johnson, unbelievable. She doesn't have the name recognition, but I've been trying to do that so I can go out and find the plane where she is. I know roughly where it is. Just while we're on submersibles, just to sort of finish off, I mean, you know, we've talked a little bit about them. The future of submersibles, like we've mentioned the exosuit. Is that the future? Is that the kind of thing that we're excited about? Or is there any new technology that you're like, wow, this is going to be terrific?
You know, the technology that exists now is amazing, but it's kind of like space. It's very expensive. And it requires a lot of effort to put a person to the deepest parts of the ocean. It's the same with space travel. It's not to the point where it's within the realm of the average person. But that will change, just like we've seen with remotely operated vehicles. You know, the remotely operated vehicles that I was using even 10 years ago were the size of a vehicle. Now they're the size of a suitcase. So as time goes by and there's different iterations of technology, you know, they get better, they get, you know, higher definition, you know, they get smaller. And I'm sure it'll be the same with submersibles. And the one thing about Titan is it's really ignited this interest in not only submersibles, but undersea exploration. I've been doing all kinds of interviews and, you know, and I've been writing all kinds of, you know, articles more in the last month than I have in my career. As he said, it's really, unfortunately, it's caught the attention of people everywhere.
Yeah, no, it really did. But hopefully some good will come from it in terms of your field, in terms of what you do, and as well as the way that we build these things, the way that we legislate and the way that we have rules. And so it's not so Wild West. Not that it's Wild West, but I don't know. Hopefully the playing field will be leveled a bit.
Well, there needs to be more oversight. And clearly, you know, the governments worldwide need to make sure that an incident like Titan doesn't happen within their jurisdiction.
Rob, it's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a real treat talking to you, Dallas.
Thank you very much for taking the time to come on.
Oh,
thank you.
My pleasure.
So there we go. Thank you very much for listening. I hope that was an illuminating episode. Hope you enjoyed that episode. And of course, if you're enjoying the series, don't forget to tell all your friends. If you would, we would be very grateful. And if you know someone who's interested in exploration generally, make sure that you send them this particular episode. And of course, if you've got a suggestion for a topic you'd like us to cover, however niche, however strange, however peculiar, you can email us at patented@historyhit.com. Thank you very much for your company. I'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
While I still have you, very briefly, if you fancy getting all of the History Hit podcast archive and new episodes ad-free, along with hundreds of history documentaries to watch, download our app across Apple App Store, Google Play, and smart TV platforms. Follow the link in the show notes or go to historyhit.com/subscribe. There is thousands of hours of history on there, including a documentary on science in the Middle Ages with Seb Volk, and also one with me talking about the secret history of the space race. As a patented listener, you get a special gift if you use the code Patented at the checkout. You get 50% off your first 3 months. That's Patented for 50% off your first 3 months. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free podcast episodes within the Apple app.